In the sombre aftermath of his departure from the hallowed turf, the retired footballer finds himself ensnared in a tumultuous whirlwind of longing, desperately seeking solace in the shadows of former glories. With each passing day, the echoes of adulation that once reverberated through packed stadiums fade into a haunting silence, leaving behind a void that he futilely attempts to fill with the fleeting allure of drink, drugs, women, and the seductive whispers of wealth. Yet, in his relentless pursuit of excess, he finds only the hollow echoes of past euphoria, a stark reminder of the ephemeral nature of fame and the transient ecstasy it bestows. Will he ever escape the self-destructing life of hedony that he has become accustomed?
Sorry, Ian, my washing machine's on, so I'm just going to close my door here.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the CSI Football Podcast, where we embark on a forensic delve into a particular season of football, usually with a tartan tint. I'm your host, Ian Stephen, and for today's episode, we meet a man who is named onomatopoeically. Playing in the hedonistic days of the 1980s in Paisley, he chose a different method of propping up the bar and overt solicitation. It's David Winnie. David, how are you, sir?
Fine, Ian, fine. Thank you for inviting me on your show.
No worries at all. So, David, let's start at the beginning. Where were you born and brought up, sir?
I was born in Bells Hill. I started in a little village, Chapel Hall, in Lanarkshire. I moved through to Paisley when I was about 8. And from there, in a football sense, I went to my local club at the time, St Mirren. I used to get a lift over the fence or the gate, whatever it was then, at Love Street. And it was there that I started to watch the game, to take part in it in a serious way type thing, through St Mirren.
So St Mirren were your boyhood team?
Me and my pal used to go down to Love Street. Somebody would usually oblige for giving us a lift over the style as you did in those days. And we used to watch St Mirren. You know, at that point, it was Fergie's Furies, I think they were called at that point. We'd watch them storming to the First Division title, and then they went into the Premier League. And at that point, I was then getting involved in football in a plain sense, more seriously. And I went down to the club for trials. Along with the Celtic, about Central St Mirren, and then it was an old, in those days it was an S4 club, and into the club then, and it just went from there, really. That's a long story short with it.
Well, I actually used to work in the turnstiles for St Mirren when I was a lot younger, when I was at university, and it was a heck of an ethical dilemma, because guys would come up and say, just lift the wee man over, pal, and I'd be like, I don't know if I can or not. I don't want to say no and look really mean, but I don't know if, like, what supervisors would run around and shout at us. Why was St Mirren's youth recruitment at that time so good? Because there was a whole host of players, even in Scotland's most expensive player at the time, came out of St Mirren and Peter Weir. So why was the recruitment so good?
I think you could probably put it down to the great man again, Alex Ferguson. He started it. I remember training with him one night, him and a couple of the other coaches over at the gravel pitches, the red ash pitches in the west end of Paisley. And although he was a manager of the team, the first team, he took to do was every nut and bolt of the club. So he knew the younger players, he'd go and watch the S-forms training, and he'd oversee that as well. Even if he took part in it, but he'd oversee it and look at it and chip in now and again. So he had his finger in every at the club and knew what was going on, and he wanted it done a certain way. So I think from there, the club was starting to produce really, really good players that come through and played in the first team. You know, the club itself benefited from it. We got on to win, you know, Scottish Cup, etc. And also was selling players on to clubs and higher up the tree in Scotland and down in England. But I think you could, to answer your question, I think you could put it down to Alex Ferguson and the club then following his methods.
Do you remember your debut? How old were you? Who was it against?
I do. It was against Hearts at Tynecastle. I think I just had just turned 17, and it was an old, remember the old League Cup sections?
Mm-hmm.
Back in the dim and dirty, it's like there was the League Cup sections. Anyway, at this point, St Mirren couldn't progress into the next stages of the quarterfinals, semi, whatever it might be. And I think in our group, it was ourselves, Hearts, Rangers, and another. So someone couldn't do anything. So I think he thought, right, we'll bring this young lad in and see what he can do. So I remember it was a kind of Wednesday night show in Tynecastle. It's the first time I'd actually played at their pitch. And I was actually struck more than anything. I've liked Tynecastle. I've always liked Tynecastle. It's a probably a proper old fashioned ground. But I walked out the tunnel and there's a smell. I was thinking, what the hell is this smell? It was the, you know, the Hops, the brewery in behind the stand, you know, across the maze. It was in certain nights, on certain days even, you could smell this Hops brewery smell. And it was lovely. I thought, oh, this will love this place. It was a great smell. And, you know, it was just a kind of waft of beer in the air or Hops or whatever it was. But the game itself, I was playing, I think I was wide left that night for some reason in a midfield. And I was up against an old experienced player in Walter Kidd. Exactly. And Walter was an old season pro. And the first tackle, I always remember it, I received it out in the touchline. And my back was to Walter and he just comes straight to the back of me and dumped me onto that in those days it was the cinders, you know, the red gravel on the main stand side. That was my introduction to first team football. And I looked up at him and he just gave me that Walter Kidd smile as if, you know, every time you're going to get the ball tonight, son, you're going to end up in your back. And it's welcome to professional football. And he did. Every time I got the ball, he just kicked me and kicked me and kicked me. But you soon learn that's the name of the game. And it was the name of the game in those days. You know, it was no prisoners were taken and no quarter was given. And you just got on with it. That was the name of the game.
So when you became a season pro in the final throes of your career and you saw a young 17 or 18 year old running out onto the pitch, did you get a flashback for Walter Kidd or were you more genial to them breaking them into the game?
I was probably more genial, to be honest. But also, I mean, I remember I think it was either my second or my third game that I played, and it was at Love Street. And I think it was my second game. And we played Aberdeen, actually. And Aberdeen, the previous week, I think they just won the Super Cup. So you can do the maths. I was 84, 85 around about then. And again, it was a kind of a Wednesday night game. I can't remember. But Aberdeen and the Sect at that point in time, you know, they'd won the Super Cup. They were arguably the best team in the world at that point. And this was my second game against them. And I remember they beat us 3-0 at Love Street. And they weren't a team that, like Celtic or Rangers in those days, that just threw everything at you, you know, the kitchen sink, etc., and bombarded you in the hope that they could batter the door down. Aberdeen at that point were a team that literally picked you apart. They probed you for weaknesses constantly, and wherever they found it, they straight in. But they dealt with other teams in a more precise and calculating manner. Whereas at that point in that time, Celtic and Rangers were just like, you know, swing everything at you and see what happens. And if you could resist that, then you were in with a chance. Whereas Aberdeen were more thoughtful in the way they took you apart. And that's what they did last night, that night. And I also, in the second half, I get sent off. And I tripped Gordon Strachan off. And to be fair to him, he came over to the referee and said, look, the lad never done. And I just fell over him, fell over his leg. But the referee had none of it, and he sent me off. So that was a really my introduction to professional football and Aberdeen in particular. But in Gordon Strachan's in trying to help me, he went straight up to the referee after the tackle and said, look, the lad never meant anything. I just fell over his leg. But as I say, the referee wasn't having any of it.
Well, we're running through Scotland managers here because, of course, Fergie managed Aberdeen in 86, Scotland in 86. Gordon Strachan was Scotland manager for a couple of qualification runs. And a current incumbent manager, Stevie Clark, he was your teammate as you broke in. He's one of the seasoned players in that defence. And what's your memories of Stevie Clark when you were coming through as a youngster?
Stevie was a man of few words, but when he spoke, he listened. Even at that age, I could tell he was a good player, Stevie. But there was I always remember once, we had an incident at Love Street at half-time. it was when Alec Miller was the manager, and his assistant at that point was a chap, Martin Ferguson, Alec's brother. And, you know, Martin was a like his brother. He knew the game inside out, back to front, you know, seasoned man. But for whatever reason, you know, Alec Miller was, we're all sitting, you know, having a drink at halftime. Tea in those days, there wasn't any of these fancy drinks. He just had a cup of tea. And Alec was chatting away about something to Stevie Clark, saying, telling him this and that, what he had to do, blah, blah, blah. And Stevie was arguing back. You know, Stevie wasn't a wallflower. He would give as good as he got if he thought there was a point to be made. And he's giving Alec, you know, giving it back to him. And Martin is in the corner at the dressing room at Love Street. And in those days, even at halftime, they put a tray of, you know, Scottish pies, a tray of pies in the corner. Not that anybody would eat it at halftime. You know, they just put them there anyway. But Martin's getting tucked into these pies. And Martin's eating these pies. You know, they're cut in half and he's chewing away at them. And Alec Miller's getting stuck into Stevie, and Stevie's giving it back. So Martin thought he'd interject on Alec Miller's behalf. So Martin starts shouting at Stevie, and Stevie jumps up, you know, to go to Martin, because Martin's kind of, it's one of these kind of threatening ones. Martin's, you know, going face to face with Stevie. Stevie's jumped up. Unfortunately, in those days, the floor at the dressing room in Love Street is like tiles. They don't react well with metal studs. So Stevie was slipping and sliding, and Martin, the two of them grappled each other, and Stevie slipped, and Martin had a pie in his hand, and it flew up in the air, and it landed, he was sitting beside Campbell Money, remember the goalkeeper, Campbell. The pie landed in Campbell's head, and Martin's spitting out pie, and the two of them are rolling about the floor in this pack. You know, you can see the kind of the comic value in this one, yeah. And it's all descended into what you'd call a good old-fashioned stramash. So we're pulling Stevie off Martin. Stevie's covered in pie. Martin's face is bright red. Campbell's got half a pie to top his head. Alec Miller's trying to regain a bit of semblance. You know, because you only get 15 minutes, you know, half time. And I forgot what the whole issue was, but it's that one. You remember the advert that Nike had when with the Brazil team and the Portuguese team, where they're running out and after kicking lumps at each other onto the pitch? It was a bit like that, because we're all jogging out after it, and Stevie's like this, and Martin's this. There's a real comic element to it. You know, if there was a fly in the wall, you know, that'd have been it. You know, they'd have had a laugh. But yeah, no, that was, I remember that with Stevie. But I mean, he was a really good player. There's no doubt in that. I mean, and obviously you can tell by the career he had at Chelsea.
Alec Miller as his manager, because I mean, he had a very long career in Scottish football, but he always came across as a kind of dour and serious character. Was that just a public persona? Was he different behind the scenes?
No, Alec is, you know, where Alec Ferguson was a swashbuckler. You know, Alec Ferguson, I think it was better to have a go and end up with nothing than half a loaf. Alec Miller was better half a loaf than nothing. So it's a glass half empty rather than a glass half full with Alec Miller. But I think at the time when he came to St Mirren, it was probably what the club needed in terms of structure, organisation, and how we went about things. But I think it got to the stage where he always had a team talk on a Friday, you know, after training, and whoever we were playing, Holiday, Dundee, Rangers, whatever it might be. We'd have this team talk for about nearly 2 hours about the team that we were going to play that day, whether it be at home or away. And he would get into all the strengths and weaknesses of the opposition in minutiae. And I always remember again one time, I mean, Frank McGarvey, Frank was, you know, we're all sitting there and getting into, I think we're playing Dundee at home. And about an hour and a half in, Frank's like, oh, he's watching out. And I was like, you got to go somewhere, Frank. He goes, I'm going to get my dinner today. And who do we play anyway? Real Madrid? You know, it was like that kind of thing. And we all first started laughing. And Alec Miller, you know, he didn't take it too well. That was Alec Miller. You could never say that he was not prepared. I think in the end of his time at St Mirren, it becomes stifling for the team. It goes to a point, you know, because I think with him, We qualify for the USA Cup, for the first time in many years. I remember we played Slavia Prague, and another team I can remember. But he'd got us to that level, but I think with his methods at that point, it had run its course at St Mirren. And from there, we had Alex Smith, who was a breath of fresh air for us at that time, as a group of players and as a club.
The footballing gods are always quite circumspect with how they choose to play out the game of football. And Alex Miller, a serious manager, was given maybe two of the less serious players in his squad at that time, McAvaney and McDougall. How did Alex cope with two players who like to love life, shall we say?
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, I don't remember much about Frank McDougall. Frank left fairly early in my time at the club. But I always remember we had a big long mirror in the dressing room. And at the end of training, every day, Frank, we used to call him Moose. I don't know why, but we used to call him Moose. He'd be standing in front of the mirror and he'd a wee quiff at the front of his hair and he'd be like, he's here, you know, looking like that, for about half an hour. And it was weird. And that was my impression of Frank then. And then, you know, lo and behold, he's off to Aberdeen and, you know, the rest is history with that. But McAvaney, Frank was, who would you describe Frank? A maverick. Yeah, he was a great player. I mean, he's one of probably the best strikers I've played with. But he was a maverick. And he was a real kind of a Glasgow street player. He was gallus. He was a great player to play with. Because I remember, for a period I moved into midfield at St Mirren for a wee while. And to play with him was fantastic. It was just a pity I didn't get longer to play with him. Because then, the end of his time, I was having a great period in my career in midfield. And he then just moved to West Ham. He got moved to West Ham. But Frank was a wonderful off-the-cuff player. Some of the stories about him were addressing him. He'd come in on a Monday for training, if at all, but he'd generally come in late, and you could guarantee that he'd have a pocket full of peppermints. He used to sit in the corner at the dressing room. Yeah, we used to call it Peppermint Corner, because it was him, a lad Jimmy Rooney, and a guy, Brian Gallagher, and they were at Canmore, the three of them. As a young player, it was like Billy Conley actually described it well when he was introduced to, it was a welder or something in the shipyards in Govan. For me as a young player, it was an introduction to that type of character, because the three of them were from Glasgow, the East End, and, you know, they were real characters, and you had to have your wits about you, because they would piss out you all the time. I was just, a young boy at the time, another story. I used to cycle up and down from my house in Paisley to Love Street and back up. So it was down the hill, literally all the way, and up the hill and back up. And it was great on the way down, brilliant. And I used to park my bike in a wee cubbyhole under the main stand. And Frank and probably A and other found out where my bike was. And they used to let the tyres down and take away the pump off my bike. So I had to wheel my bike all the way back home. Exactly. And I was just so naive then. I just think, you know, who was doing this? So I pumped the tyres back up, back down, and they do the same every other day until somebody told me at the club, do you know what? McAvaney's went and laid out your tyres. So there was that kind of character. You know, they were great fun. They'd always be taking the mickey out of you, but you had to be sharp, you know, because they were really sharp as tacks with their Glasgow humour. And it was a good environment to learn the game in, because to be fair to them, they were good players as well.
You're a family man, David, a respected member of your community professionally and socially. I don't know if you can answer this question. Did you ever go on a night out with Frank?
It's a month. We had a few nights out, I have to say. Frank wasn't the only character in that team. I would say that I was probably a bit young with Frank, you know, in terms of going out with, but I'd have been putting my life in my hands, to be honest. But I do remember that when we won the Scottish Cup, we straight after it, because we didn't really get the opportunity to enjoy winning the cup in Hertfordshire back in Paisley, back in Scotland. We flew straight down to Heathrow and then straight to Singapore. We played a big tournament in Singapore straight after it, and we won that as well. I think there was Sultana, you know, the Premier League champions of Mexico and the champions of Australia at the time. And as I say, we won that tournament, but a boy in the team at the time, they took it as an excuse to have a bit of a holiday as well. And there's a lad, another lad in the team, Billy Abercrombie. I don't know if you remember him. Mm-hmm. He was a captain of the team at the day we won the final. Billy was a quiet, unassuming wee guy, but he's the hardest player I've ever seen in my career. He's the only guy I've ever seen that's kicked Graeme Souness and he's, you know, nailed him. He was from the East End of Glasgow, and he was the hardest guy ever. You talk about hard men in football, he was a hard man, a real, real hard man. And he would break your leg and smile at you. We used to call him Abba, wee Abba. We went to Singapore, and then, you know, it was the Scottish FA Cup winners in this tournament. And Abba, with all due respect to him, he liked to drink now and again. And when we went to Singapore, he fully indulged, shall we say. And him and another player in the team. And we were there for, I think it was 10, 12 days. And we played these three games. Abba went missing for 3 days. Literally went missing. And I think the jungles of Singapore are, you know, and around in that area. We had to keep it quiet because it would have been a major event if the captain of Scottish Cup winners went AWOL and couldn't find us. Luckily, he came back, him and the other player, but he looked like a panda because he's got two black eyes. And Alex Smith at the time and Jimmy Bone, the assistant, were furious. As you can imagine, they were spitting sailors. But we decided to keep it quiet for the benefit of all because it had been a major, major incident. If the press had got hold of it, it'd have been insane. Abba disappeared for 3 days. And he came back, like, looking out of an extra. You remember that show was on the telly years ago, Tenko?
Yeah.
He looked like one of them. I think he'd eaten for about 3 or 4 days. I don't know what he'd existed on in a liquid form, but him and the other lad were really worth their weight in the series. Two black eyes, nothing else was said. And it was like, thank God they're still here. Because if we had had to report that the captain and another would have gone missing and get the police involved and la 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 la, you can imagine the furore that would have caused. Yeah. So yeah, it was Abba had been in the team for years. He was there when I was a kid as well. So he was another character. And so a team full of them.
I used to live and work in Singapore, David. So I've got a good
what
idea.
What did you exactly? Yeah,
I don't know where they went. Here's a good question, because I think you were at the club at the time. Feyenoord turned up to play Superman in a European time.
Yeah.
And Cruyff and Hullet were in that team. Do you remember them?
Vividly. I was a young boy at the time, a young lad at the time. And I was just, was it about 14, 15 at the time? So the night before the game at Love Street, the team is allowed to train on the pitch. I think it still holds today. They're allowed to train on the pitch the night before. It's a UEFA regulation or a UEFA rule. So Feyenoord are training on the pitch. So I go down, you know, thirst for knowledge, and I know is playing that the following day. So I'm in the stand watching them. And it was brilliant, you know, to watch a real, real quality team, Joyce, Hullet, and the rest of them playing. Anyway, they're wrapping up their training session. So I go downstairs and I'm in the boot room. It's a little cubby hole. It's a bit like, you know, the Anfield boot room. It's a tiny little thing underneath the stand. And I'm in there. Part of my duties as a young boy there, I was to clean the boots for the players. I was cleaning the boots. Anyway, I'm facing a wall and it's, you know, I thought the final players had gone. And anyway, in walks these two guys. Hello, have you got a brush? And I turn and it's Johan Cruyff and Hullet. And I'm like, my jaw just falls open. And he goes, do you have a brush? He's got his boots in his hand, him and the toilet. They've got their brushes in their hand. And their boots in their hand. And I said, no, I'll clean them for you. Don't worry, you put them there. And I'll no, we'll clean them. So, right, fine. So we sit down and we're little chairs. And so I said, get the toilet on one side, Johan Cruyff on the other. And they're sitting cleaning football boots. And I'm, you know, they're talking to me, how you doing? What's your name? You know, where are you playing? Dad, I've just started in making my way to the club. I've not even played in the first team yet. And I didn't know Rutula at the time because he was just making his way. He was 18, 19. But the following night, he was, you know, I think he scored actually. So I remember him then, but he was just this big lad that, you know, he looked like a mountain. And obviously there's Johan Cruyff, who legend speaks for itself. So he's talking to me about my, you know, what I'm doing, and so is Jude Tullett. And it was a surreal experience because I've got these two superstars in wee stools in the bowels of the boot room at Pay, cleaning football boots, you know, sit, you know, brushing the mud off your boots. And see, to be honest, if they'd given me the boots and said, you know, can you let them clean, I'd have done it. You know, Johan Cruyff's football boots, brilliant. You know, for Johan Cruyff is a hero of mine. So he's sitting in front of me talking to me about football. And you know, we're talking about the game and blah, blah, all different things. And it was one of those moments you think, that's what football's about, you know, because you don't, these days, I don't know if it's happened, but you sit and chat away about, right, you need to do this, you need to do that, and think about this and think about that in the game. I'm just soaking it all up. And I think I'd probably rub the leather off to the boots by the time. It's funny because cleaning his boots and, you know, I couldn't give a damn about it. I'm just listening to these two talk about football and how the game should be played in this little cubbyhole in the bowels of this stadium. And we're sitting and I don't even think it was chairs. It was like big tin cans or something. I don't know. I can't remember. But it was a murky wee place, you know, as you can imagine, in those days with the football boots. So anyway, we finished and said, you know, the two of them, thanks very much. You know, we'll look out for you. And they walk out and I'm like, my jaw, to literally pick my jaw off the floor. And I'm thinking, yeah, I've just met two superstars here. Well, I knew one of them in Cruyff, but the other guy thought, because I looked at him, as I said, and he, you know, you can just tell when somebody looks like, and this lad looked like a superstar. And he proved, you know, his career, you know, went on to do what he did. But yeah, that's my one takeaway from St Mirren against Feyenoord.
Did anybody believe you when you tried telling the story?
No, I couldn't. It was, you know, Ian, it's like a sliding doors moment, because I'm down in the bowels of the stadium, because I'd go to watch teams just to get an idea of what they're doing, you know, with the European games that we had. And at that point, I'd been assigned to go and clean football boots, as all young apprentices as it were. So I'm cleaning the boys' boots for the following day, and there was very few people in the stadium that night. And then could, you know, that way we can feel a presence in behind you. And I turned down and it's the master himself and his apprentice. And usually I can talk, but I was like a blubbering idiot about that, you know, because you meet your hero. Sometimes your heroes let you down when you meet them in real life, but this guy, definitely not. I could have sat there for weeks and chatted to this lad, Johan Cruyff, about football, you know, and his mate, Rudjula. So yeah, when I tell people about it, they think I'm daft, or they don't think I'm daft, they think I'm kidding on, but yeah, no, that happened.
Well, the season that kind of sticks out for you in your St Mirren career is the 86-87 season, especially at the end of the 86-87 season, but it didn't start very well. It was not the greatest kind of run of results in the league.
No.
And then at Christmas, the manager moved on, Alex Miller left, and Alex Smith came in. So what was different about Alex Smith coming into the club? I think he came from Stirling Albion.
Yeah. I think it was just as I'd said about this, you know, Alex Miller was good for a period at the club, and he was the right person at the right time to stabilise the club and get some structure and order. But then it became too rigid, and he kind of thrown a blanket over the team and wouldn't allow us to play, as it were. I mean, had good players in the team. At that time, you know, McGarvey, Ian Ferguson, Paul Lambert, with a really good young team in the making. So anyway, Alex Smith came in, and it was at that point, it was literally a breath of fresh air for the team and the players. And he identified him and Timmy Bone straight away that we had a bulk of about six or seven really good young players. And he was all for giving them their head, just letting them go and play, and encouraged us to go out and play. And I had a bad ankle injury at the start of the season, and that kept me out. So, you know, I think I'd broken it, but I hadn't had it treated properly. So I'd been out for quite a bit of that seat, the early part of the season with Alec Miller. But when Alec Smith came in, for me and everybody else in the club, it was like, as I say, a breath of fresh air. And it just went from there. His methods and how he wanted the game played started to seep into the team, and particularly in cup games, you know, the Scottish Cup, we really started to click, and we got a settled team together. And I think half of it was filled with teenagers and odd boys that were, you know, 20, 21 at most. They really started to play.
It was quite interesting because McIverney had left at this point, and
yeah,
the St Mirren decided to splash out a young player, Ian Ferguson from Clyde, who came in and hit the ground running. What was your memories of Ferguson joining the club?
Fergie, Ian was you know, Ian was power personified. He was he could change a game just with one swing of that right boot of his, which he did for us, you know, on many occasions. He could be doing nothing in the game and he could be having a terrible game, but, you know, he could get the ball, turn and whack. He was that type of player. He was brute force, Fergie. I mean, don't get me wrong, he could play. He could really play. But there was a kind of unleashed power in the way he played. And Alex Smith kind of managed to harness that with Fergie and use it in the right way. But as I said as well, we also had, you know, young players coming through, like Paul Lambert, who he started to get the best out of, and Brian Hamilton and me and Ian Cameron. So we were all 18, 19-year-old. And he had the foresight and the courage, Alex Smith has, to put all of these young boys, it's half a team full of teenagers. You know, not many managers, not many coaches would do that. Put us in and they let us play. Okay, you're going to have up and down days, as you get with players at that age and maturity. But the trajectory was that way for this team. It was really going. And it was just unfortunate the team couldn't stay together. Because after winning the Scottish Cup, I'm kind of jumping a bit forward here. After the Scottish Cup, the team that played the Scottish Cup.
That's a spoiler, David. Nobody knew you'd won yet.
I know. But the team that won the Scottish Cup, that team never played together again. That was the last time I ever played together as a team. So, you know, it was one of those things. But yeah, taken aback a wee bit, we were starting to, there was a belief coming through the players and the team, with a bit of luck, we could take anything.
Well, I mean, it started off really positively against Inverness Caledonian. They hadn't added the Thistle on at this point. A 3-0 win at Love Street, McDowell, McGarvey and Ferguson on the score sheet. Maybe a game you were expected to win because they were Highland League at that point. But it set up one heck of a fourth round tie against Morton at Capello. But what are your memories of that match? Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, that even now, like however many years later, I'm thinking that's a game I would definitely like to watch.
To be honest, I don't remember it because I had a recurrence with my ankle injury. You know, I told you I'd broken it earlier that year and I've had a recurrence of it again. I didn't play that day and I wasn't even at the game. So I don't remember it. And you know, if you can give you a commentary on it. The boys after it, they did play well and they knew it that day. As I said, the team was starting to have belief in itself, and Alex Smith was all for that. And, you know, his assistant, Jimmy, he was the same. He was giving the young boys the confidence to go and play and to make mistakes. And the whole club, there was a feel-good factor in the club that it was going places and it was going up the way. That mood just kept building. And in terms of the Scottish Cup, he kept saying to us, look, we've got, I think it's five games or six games, you know, from the start to winning the final, whatever it might be at that time. He goes, we've got six games to make history. That's all we need to win, just six games. And the boys started to believe it with each game that we clocked off and each round that we got through. We started to say, yeah, we could maybe do this. And it, you know, as it turned out, we did.
Did you play against Morton many times?
I did. I know it was a derby game, but to be honest with me, it was just another game. You know, when I went to Aberdeen, you had Aberdeen Rangers and there was a real animosity that you could feel between particularly Aberdeen fans towards Rangers fans and even playing Celtic when I was at Aberdeen, not to the same extent, but, and even when I played at Hearts for a bit, I played in the Hibby. I never felt that with Morton and St Mirren. You know, all due respect to him, I think it was too parochial. It was, you know, it wasn't a big enough event for it to be, you know, to make me nervous anyway as a young lad. So I never felt, you know, any great nerves in a derby.
Well, the quarterfinals, it was Raith Rovers at Stark Park, Godfrey and Chalmers scoring in that one. Chalmers had actually got two against Morton as well. And it set up semi-final match against Hearts. And semi-finals, people say semi-finals are harder than the finals sometimes. What's your memory of that semi?
No, he's right. He's right. Whoever said that or made that comment, they're right.
Let's just say it was me. Make me sound intelligent.
Yeah, you're right. Because I remember Hearts at that point were one of the top clubs, you know, because missed out and won the league, I think, a year or so before. So they were a good team. And there wasn't this disparity between the clubs these days as there was in those days. You know, you Carts, Dundee United, Aberdeen, they could easily beat Celtic and Rangers, no problem. It was like a five or six teams that could easily beat each other. Anyway, it was the same thing with Alex Smith. You know, we went pretty much feeling all that. We stayed at Seamill Hydro the night before, down in the Ayrshire Coast, to prepare for it. And again, he said, look, one game, one more game, we're in the final. And he changed the team because I had come back from my injury by then, and Peter Godfrey had played the previous two cup games, the Raith Rovers and the Morton game. But he brought me back into the team again. And Paul Chalmers had scored, as you'd said. But he put Fergie in, I think, because it was Fergie and Frank McGarvey front, and Paul Chalmers was out. And to be honest, I thoroughly enjoyed it. Actually, I really enjoyed the game from start to finish. And I remember I set up Ian Ferguson Ferry for the winning goal. But it was right from the get go, I felt we can beat Hearts. Again, through Alex Smith and Jimmy speaking to this young team, because half the team were teenagers and they didn't have that fear that, oh, this could be my last final, or you know, the worries that keep through your mind, I think, as you become a older seasoned pro. It was more of a kind of carefree young kid type thing. We'd have a laugh and joke about it as a team, but we had good players. And had Tony Fitzpatrick and wee Pally Abercrombie and Frank McGarvey there just as the seasoned heads just to keep us right. But it was a bit like the Bath Street kids, you know, we were good players. You don't get to that level, you don't get to that stage if you're not a semi-decent team. And
I was going to say, your form really kind of dipped off after that semi-final, because you drew with Falkirk, drew with Hibs, lost to Celtic, lost to Accies, lost to Rangers, and you're having to face Dundee United, who were in the UEFA Cup final at that point. Then having Rangers and Celtic in a final, that must have been one of the biggest kind of gaps between a favourite and an underdog, no disrespect to St Mirren. But
no, you're right. Yeah, I remember the form dipped deliberately. Everybody, because we had a very small squad of players at the club, you know, as a club of that size at the time, and everybody was trying to protect themselves. We were playing, and we were playing at most in third gear in those games after the semi-final, because we had this big opportunity. None of the players, maybe with the exception of McGarvey, had played in a cup final. So this was a first for everybody. So we didn't want to get injured. So we deliberately, you could feel it, we'd taken the foot off the gas. But come the final, again, we played Dundee United, we played Hearts, and we knew what they were about. We as a club and a team felt we were on a par with them, regardless of United's exploits. And I remember as well, because they played Barcelona and beat them to get to the final against Gothenburg. So Dundee United were no mugs. They were a good, good team. You know, they could have taken anybody in Europe and, you know, if not beating them, giving them a right good game.
The Billy Thompson Scotland International, David Neary, Maurice Malpass, Eamon Bannon, David Bowling, Jim McInally, Paul Sturrock, Paul Hegarty, Kevin Gallagher, all Scotland Internationals.
Yeah, it's, you know, we knew, you know what, we're up against it here, but we had a good team as well. And it's, maybe it was Alex Smith, maybe he's a great man at, you know, letting people know that he's got a good hand when he's actually maybe not got quite such a good hand to play. and a good poker player. But he made us as a team feel at Hampden in that dressing room before the final, you know what, we can beat Dundee United. Despite the fact that they're in the UEFA Cup final, despite the fact they've beaten Barcelona, despite the fact they've beaten whoever else before that, despite the fact they're one of the best teams in Europe. And to be honest, the final was rubbish. It was crap. I mean, I think we employed a subtle tactic, Dundee United. We bored them into defeat because we did know that Dundee United that season had played about 60 or 70 games. And they had a very small squad that, you know, Jim McLean, he trusted these players, but they only had about 13 or 14 max. And a lot of them were getting on. So they were running in fumes at that point, in which proved correct in the final, because I think Eamon Bannon just ran out of gas. So we knew that as long as we kept ourselves in a game in the first half, we'd grow into it. Because again, Dundee United was similar to Aberdeen at that point in that they probed you all the time. It wasn't like Celtic and Rangers that just threw the kitchen sink at you in the hope that they'd break the door down, as it were. Dundee United and Aberdeen were like smart European-style teams that they'd constantly probe you for weaknesses. And if you weren't up to it, or if you weren't on, you know, ready, they'd score. You know, they were a clever team. So tactic was to contain them in the first half, first 30, 40 minutes, and then see how we could break out. And really, that was the way it went, that game. It was, I mean, from a spectator's point of view, I mean, I'll apologise right now. It was just such a poor game. It was like a slugfest in the rain.
Well, I will accept your apology because I was in the crowd that day. I was there as a neutral.
I mean, as well, we relied on Fergie and Ferguson to score and to play and, you know, produce a bit of brilliance. But Fergie, by his own admission that day, he was rubbish. He was crap. You know, he couldn't kick his backside that day. And the only thing he did was win as the cup. You know, he swung that left boot as and bang, the rest is history.
You wanted a goal from Ian Ferguson, but you got a goal from the wrong Ian Ferguson because it was United Ian Ferguson that scored. And it was contentious at the time. I think Ur would have a very kind of interesting look at it nowadays. You were maybe one of the closest people on the pitch. Was it onside or offside, David? Let's get definitive.
Well, Kevin Gallagher, he was standing on the goal line when Ian Ferguson put it in, and offside or not, he was blocking Campbell Money's, because Campbell's trying to get across to save the ball, and Kevin Gallagher was standing right in the goal line, blocking him anyway, so he couldn't get over to it. And as well, there was nobody, obviously, beyond Kevin Gallagher. So, I mean, technically, the way I see it, it's offside. But would VAR have another view of it these days? You never know. When the goal went in, to say my heart sank was an understatement, because we'd gone that long. Both teams were starting to really tire because we both had long, hard seasons, particularly United. So it was beginning to be, it was like two prize fighters slugging it out in the mud and the rain. But we got a letter. And I think it was just maybe a two or three minutes after that, I can't recall. Fergie ran up the park, or he got a through ball and just smashed one. The only thing he did that day. And that was it. We knew once he'd scored that we'd won the game. I think it was about 5 or 6 minutes left. Oh, there's a member as well that he scored and he ran towards the Rangers' end where all the St Mirren fans were. And I was almost in my own penalty box when he'd scored, because I think Brian Hamilton had lost a long one through to him and he'd run on. For me to run from our penalty box behind the goals into the Rangers' end, I was so tired I took cramp. Leighton Fergie, and I jumped on him and I took cramp in my left leg because I was so tired. I'm hobbling back and thinking, right, there's about 5 minutes left. We need to keep, you know, we need to hold this, because it'd been a rear guard action most of the game. But we knew, looking at United players, they were done. The bubble had burst for them, and they'd nothing, absolutely nothing left. And we knew we'd won that game.
Was the rest of that day a blur? Because the kind of town of Paisley came out in their thousands just to welcome the bus coming back.
It was. And it was just, there was that, you just trying to, you know, you're trying to take it all in. because these moments don't really come along that often. But it was a blur. I do remember that night, because we had a big function in the town hall in Paisley, and the town and the mayor and all that had come out, and it was literally, I don't know, 20,000-30,000 people around in Paisley in the town centre. And then we did a big meal at the hotel, you know, right by Glasgow Airport. There's the big tall one. I can't remember what it was called then. We had that because we were flying out to Singapore the following day, but we'd had a big reception in there that night. And I was there, and Gordon McQueen was there, all of these. And actually, after the game in the dressing rooms at Hampden, Sergei had come in, Alex Ferguson, you know, former manager of the club, and he's congratulating Alex Smith and going around, you know, Tony Fitzpatrick, you know, he knew Tony well, he's a former player, and he's going around me and all that. What he's doing, typical Fergie, he's putting little markers in for the younger players, you know, it's like, here's my card type thing. And he's, because there's a whole host of managers and scouts from every Premier League club in the UK outside the front door. But Fergie, because of his connections to the club and who he was, he get in, he literally just walked in the dressing room door, larger than life character, you know, ah, well done boys, you know, brilliant, and all that type of thing. And he's going to Ian Ferguson, and he's going to Colin, and he's going to me, and all the younger boys, you say, well done, you know, all of that. But it's he's using a psychological thing, you know, I'll keep you right type thing, you know, come to me first. I do remember that. But yeah, I wish, getting back to your question, I wish I could have taken it a wee bit slower in terms of enjoying the moment, because it all passed as a blur. The kind of first time we got to kind of sit down actually and reflect on it was about 12 days, 2 weeks later. We're sitting, I remember it distinctly, we're sitting in a wee cubbyhole in Heathrow Airport. It's a wee, one of these wee, you know, nondescript grotty lounges that they have at you know, these kind of airports. And we'd won the Scottish Cup, been to Singapore, played in this tournament, won that, brought that cup back. So we're sitting there with these trophies, you know, waiting for a flight to be called. And Alex Smith called us all together. Do you know what I mean? So just a wee huddle type thing, sitting around in these chairs. And she said, lads, look, I just want to thank you for what you've done for me and Jimmy and for your club and for your town. This is the first opportunity I've had to do it, because it's been such a blur. You've done yourselves, your families, the club, everybody, you've put them on the map, you've put yourselves on the map, and you've done yourselves proud. I actually, thinking about it now, I got a lump in my throat, because I remember him sitting down. Alex Smith has this way, you know, he speaks in this kind of low, deep voice that you have to sit and listen to. And he demands that respect when you speak to him, or when he speaks to you. And he just sat us down in a most auspicious set of soundings to thank all the players, each and every one of us, in a wee cubbyhole in the depths of an airport. And he's saying, thanks for what you've done. Remember that?
Well, Alex Smith eventually left. He went to join Tony Fitzpatrick, came in, and there was a shift in St Mirren's kind of transfer policy at that point. It wasn't so much bringing the young players in, they were starting to bring in players from abroad. And
yeah,
you had Gudmundur Torfason came in from Rapid Vienna. Thomas Stickrow came in from Bayer Erdogan. Mm-hmm. Somebody called Victor Munez Manrique came in from Sampdoria via Barcelona with 60 Spanish caps in his pocket. What on earth was going on?
Yeah, Tony was, to be honest, Tony, see if you cut Tony in half, he'd bleed black and white. That's Tony Fitzpatrick. He would run through brick walls for St Mirren. He's that type of man. When he was appointed manager, he came to me, and I was what age was I? I was 20 years old. And he says, I'm going to make you captain of the team. And at that point, I think I'd have been the youngest captain in the Premier League. And we'd had problems, you know, because I think when Alec left, yeah, we were fighting really. We saved ourselves. Tony kept us up. But the next season, we said, I'm going to make you captain. It was great for me. It was a great honour. And I thought, brilliant, this is superb. My career's really starting to motor. And Tony, he had no experience of coaching, not as much coaching, but managing. and he'd Frank side and Frank McGarvey. It was a great, you know, as a, from a PR point of view, you know, Tony Fitzpatrick, Frank McGarvey, assistant and manager for the club, but they had nothing to fall back on when things could go wrong, which inevitably they would with any manager and coach. I always remember the first day of the season. This is one of these kind of bittersweet things for me that, you know, I'm the captain of St Mirren, playing Rangers at Ibrox, opening day of the season at Ibrox, as I say. Rangers are the champions. They're proud in the trophy, all of that nonsense. And we go there and Tony says, we're going to beat you. And everybody else in the country think he's talking a lot of nonsense. But we went out and we beat Rangers and everybody started to set up. And I had a brilliant game that day as well, blowing my trump. I played really well. And I was getting talked about going to Spurs and Premier League, all of that, and, you know, 800,000, £1 million, all of that. I remember it in the newspapers the following day on the Sunday that I would have been staying at Sutton that long because I'd be down to South at Tottenham or Man United. Because I was a 20-year-old captain of a team that had beaten Premier League champions. Anyway, on the Monday, I went into training, everybody's cock-a-hoot, and I come back from training. At that point, I was still staying at with my mum. I come home and the doctor was in the house and I thought, what's going on here? Mum said, sit down. And the doctor, as diplomatically as he could, he says, look, your mum got cancer. She's got 6 months to live. And my dad had died when I was a young boy. So I'd only my mum left. And the doctor said, yeah. Well, he put it quite diplomatically, she's got cancer. We'll do this treatment and that treatment. So I'm in the house with my mum and the doctor's out, going out the door, and I'm taking him out the door. And I said, look, tell me the truth. How bad is it? And he said, look, you'll be lucky if she gets 6 months. So from being like copy of the North on a Saturday and, you know, feeling I'm king of the world, the way my whole world fell apart in a day. And Monday, I was just bang. And, you know, my mum died 8 months later. But during those 8 months, I just forgot about football. I told Tony that this is what's happening. And to be fair to him, he protected me. Because I'd lost so much weight just with the stress. I'd had to look after my mother, you know, going through the treatment and everything that that entails. And to be honest, football was the last thing in my mind. You know, I was captain of a club, a Premier League club. We should be doing this and that. But the last thing I wanted to do was play football. But Tony took a lot of stick, but he protected me. You know, that's the measure of the man. You know, when she died, it was a relief for me in a way, because she was no longer in pain and, you know, I could go on with life. I don't mean that to sound callous, but it was a relief for everybody, for her, my mum as well. But unfortunately, the time it had taken, I'd only get 1 year left in my contract. And by the time all of this had finished, my contract had ended. And St Mirren were only going to offer me another year, even though I was the captain, because of the circumstances. And I said no. So I went in a month-to-month contract. This was like 90. And Tony said to me, look, because you're in that contract, I'm not going to play you. I said, but I'm the captain. He said, no, I'm not going to play you anyway. So I basically just sat on my backside from the August when the season started in 1990, 89, 90, I think, to when Alex Smith came calling at Aberdeen, and I went there. But to be honest, Ian, when I went to Aberdeen, I was no shape physically or mentally to do anything, you know, because I hadn't played. I'd lost so much weight, you know. I needed at least 6 or 7 months just to get up to speed with anything.
Was it intimidating moving into that Aberdeen team, because they were starting to transition away from Miller and McLeish, but the kind of ghost of the 80s was still there?
Yeah. Everybody that went there at that time, you realise that you weren't going into just EN other clubs. It wasn't like a Hearts or even a Celtic to that, or Rangers. It was, this is a team, because Alec McLeish was still there, Willie Miller was still there, Stuart McKimmy, and you had Hans Heelhouse. You know, it was a fantastic side. Brilliant team. But Alec, in particular, Alan McLeish was a brilliant, brilliant captain. He looked after the players. He demanded everything off you, that's for sure. but he was a great captain, you know, great captain. But as you can expect with somebody like him, he demanded everything from you, you know, and to give nothing but your best every time you played. That was the way it was at Aberdeen. In those days, at the Pittodrie, it was drummed into us, beaten into us. Nobody had to beat us at Pittodrie. Nobody. Not even Rangers or Celtic. And it was seen as an absolute, not disgrace, that's a wrong word, but a real downer if we get beat by the old slum at Pittodrie.
You'd Jim Bett in that squad as well, and he was a man that played in Iceland. Was he any influence to what happened to you later in your career?
You mean in Iceland?
Yeah.
No, I mean, I see Jim often now when I go over to Iceland, because Jim lives there now. So every time I'm over, I meet up with him. In fact, I met up with him just a few weeks ago. No, Jim didn't have any influence, but Jim himself, he was an unassuming character. He was a quiet lad, but he was a bit of a joker. You know, he'd throw in little jokes here and there. But what a player he was. You don't realise how good players are until you actually see them day in, day out, and the way they play and the way they can control games. I remember we played Celtic once at Pittodrie, and I beat them. And Jim and Hans Heelhuis just tore Celtic apart. Jim was firing balls all over the pitch, and he was just controlling the game from start to finish. And I didn't realise, and again, until you're with the guy, my God, this boy can play. He's a really, really good player.
Well, you came into the team in the 92-93 season, and that was the season that Aberdeen were the ultimate bridesmaids, second in the league, and losing to Rangers in the League Cup, the Scottish Cup. And you played both of those games. Did that make, with St Mirren, that more sweeter to experience the kind of heartache and to have that special moment in your career?
I don't know if it was so much that. I mean, that was great. But I think if we'd won it with Aberdeen, it would have been bigger for me, because Aberdeen's a bigger club, you know, bigger support. And at that time, even although Rangers were spending huge amounts of money and, you know, building this impressive squad, we were still expected. There was an expectation, you know, and particularly when Willie Miller was a manager, he really drummed that into us, that we were to beat everybody. We had to find a way to win no matter what. That was Willie's way of, you know, playing. And that was the way Willie played himself. That we had to find a way to beat everybody. It didn't matter who it was. And he picked the club up and the standards from here and took them right up again. It was just unfortunate that he was up against a Rangers team that had spent oodles of money, and as we now know these days, money that they didn't have on the squad. I think it had half the England team in it and the rest of the Scottish national team. And it was a team, I think, that had gone to the semi-finals of the European Cup as well. I think in any other period, any other time, we'd have won the treble, because we knew we were better than Celtic. And Rangers were a hoodoo team. We just couldn't make that next little jump. But again, Rangers beat Leeds, you know, in the Battle of Britain. So Rangers were the best team in Britain. And I think we were close second to that point. But we just couldn't make that jump to beat them, you know. And the demands, as you can imagine then, if that had happened today, everybody would be ecstatic. You know, they'd be jumping through hoops. At that point in time, that wasn't good enough for Aberdeen. So will they get the next season? I think that's the way it worked.
I mean, you alluded to it earlier, or I alluded to it earlier, sorry, but you ended up moving to Reykjavik, and it was quite an exotic move for a Scottish footballer in those times. How did that come about?
To be honest, Ian, I wasn't enjoying Scottish football at that point anymore. I was getting the fag end of my career, as it were, and I knew where it was going, and I just wasn't enjoying football. I'd had enough of it, frankly, you know, personal things, etc. I wanted to get away from it. And I was actually approached by Johannes Edvaldsen, Shuggy Edvaldsen, played for Celtic in the 70s. Johannes approached me and he said, look, my brother, Atley, he's the manager of a team in Reykjavik, KR Reykjavik. And he says, I think, you know, he'd watched me whatever games. And he says, I think you could do a job for him. So it came at the right time for me. Because I say I wanted to get away from Scotland. I'd had enough. My career was, you know, going down the toilet, frankly. And I thought this is a breath of fresh air for me. And when I went there, I met Artley, and he was like a breath of fresh air for me. Artley had been a player himself, and he had been a really good player. He played for the national team over 100 times. He played for Borussia Dortmund. He was this, that, and that. You know, he'd been there and he'd done it. But he was a great guy. He was a great guy. And to be honest, I went there with no illusions. You know, it was the end of my career. I thought I'd join a bunch of fishermen and farmers. But it was just to get away from Scotland. I'd had enough. But I always remember my first training session. I threw the ball into this young boy, and I was going to apologise because it was a terrible throw. But he took it down in his chest, and he turned and he just rifled it into the net. And I thought, well, this young lad can play. It was either Johnson, Chelsea and Barcelona fan. And either had just, I didn't realise it, I didn't know anything to the team at that point. Either had just come back from, he did a bad injury, and he'd come back, Reykjavik had gotten from PSV Eindhoven. So he'd come back into the team. And to be honest, he actually wasn't even the best player in this team. But I could see that there was players, this wasn't just a team of fishermen and farmers, this team could play. I thoroughly, like Iceland gave me a new leash of life in every way, shape and form. It was the best thing I did. By going there, and I stayed there for 4 years, and I had a great time there.
You're something I didn't think I'd ever expect to say in this podcast, but your manager Atley was at the centre of a MI5 Russian spy ring.
No, it wasn't that actually, Ian. I don't think it was.
Had information.
Yeah, no, his dad. There was allegations that his dad. Medvald was a Nazi collaborator, and because his dad, I think, was from one of the Estonia. One of the old Russian republics.
He was the head of the police in Tallinn at the time of the Nazi occupation.
And that there was allegations that he'd, you know, rounded up Jews, etc., and sent them to the gas chambers. That had always, I think, stopped. It's nothing to do with him, you know. But he was paying for his father's sins. And I don't even know if that had been the case with his father. There was allegations, but none of it had ever... I think it's Simon Wiesenthal, the Jewish, the kind of Nazi hunter. You know, he went around getting all the old Nazis and, you know, bringing them, getting them all together and trying them. I don't think ever anything came of this with Atley's dad. But there was always allegations and the smell always hung about that his dad had been with the Nazis and had sent Jews to the gas chambers. But as I say, you can't pay for the sins of your father.
No, you talked about not liking, or don't say not liking, but you were your career in Scotland was expended, your life in Scotland was expended, and you were looking elsewhere. Was that why you moved to Canberra? Were you thinking of possibly relocating to Australia?
No, I'd finished my contract, or my first year's contract in Australia, in Reykjavik, but I'd agreed another 2-year deal with the club. But I had a kind of period before the next, you know, because they play in the summertime. So I'd almost like a year before I would go back there again. So I thought, what am I going to do? You know, and to be honest, I didn't want to go back to Scotland and play again after the period that I had in Reykjavik and Iceland, again, it was this new lease of life. Going back to Scotland at that point was like, no chance. I was contacted by a guy, Tom Sirmani, a Scotsman, who had major success with the Australian women's national team. He was now in charge of Canberra Cosmos, an NLS team in Australia. And he said, look, do you want to come over for a season and play here? And I said, well, you know, I'd need to be on loan because I have to go back to Reykjavik. He said, yeah, that's fine. Does. So I went to my summer time in the Northern Hemisphere, you know, with Iceland and all day down to, because it was getting into the winter time. So it was going down into summer time again in Australia. So I played there. Again, I loved it. You know, because you're playing in the top league in Australia. Every away game I'm flying to. And one of my former teammates at St Mirren, Brian Hamilton, he was with me. he'd come from another team, rejoined me. So it was people I knew. And you're playing against some really good players, actually. There was former players in the Italian World Cup squad. It's a bit like, you know, kind of America, where older players go and to finish their career. It was like that in Australia. But in addition, the Australians themselves were producing really good players. The lad played with a guy, Brett Emerton. You know, he was the type of player there that they were producing. So it was a good standard of team that you're playing against. Against really good players. And just the lifestyle in Australia was fantastic. You know, I lived in Canberra, which the Australians criticise it because it's just like they call it this like the East Coast Bride of Australia. But I loved it. You know, it was like a town in the mountains, you know, in Australia. And I had it was a great opportunity to see the country itself because I flew to Perth, Adelaide, Melbourne, obviously Sydney, went over to Auckland in New Zealand because there was a team there in the league. So I had a great time and I enjoyed playing football with good players and against good players and just getting a different view on life and a different perspective. So I stayed there and then went back to Reykjavik to join their season. So I had about 3 seasons where I didn't get a rest, to just playing continuously. I thought I enjoyed it.
Well, when a player, traditionally, maybe going back to the 60s and 70s, when a player's career would come to an end, they would look to go into coaching, they would look to go into maybe running a pub or postman or another kind of fairly standard kind of job. But you elected to retrain and move into a career in law. So where did that interest come from and what was the kind of stimulus for it?
I'd always had this hankering to study. I mean, when I winding it back a wee bit, when I first started at St Mirren, Alec Miller, the manager at the time, he'd impressed me to come in to sign full-time contract. But I'd got the necessary hires at school to go to university. And I was humming and hawing as to whether I would do it. But I thought, well, I could always go back to it. But the chance to go and become a football player doesn't come about every, you know, 2 weeks, as it were. So I took the plunge, I took the chance, and it went from there. But as I'd said, I'd always had the hankering to come back to football, to come back to education. And I hadn't huge sums of money out of the game that I could just sit back and retire, unfortunately. So I had to do something. And when my career was... because I'd gone back to St Mirren again toward the last kind of stop in my career. So at that point, I'd gone to my local university and I'd had a look at the prospectus. To be perfectly honest, Ian, it wasn't, I want to be a lawyer. I looked at it and I thought, right, no, I don't want to do this, I don't want to do that. And I was left with law and economics. So I'll give that a bash. And just went from there. But when I got my degree, whatever it is, 4 years later, I'd gone through the route of coaching, you know, because I'd finished it obviously at Reykjavik as a manager, and I'd finished at Dumbarton, and I'd had a wee stint as coaching at Rangers, and frankly, I'd left a sour taste in my mouth. You know, I knew coaching wasn't for me. You know, it wasn't for me, and I knew there wasn't going to be any jobs in football for me in Scotland. It was a small market. I wasn't going to sit and wait about like a dog trying to get a bone. I had to go out and get a job towards another career, otherwise I'm going to sit and draw it. And fortunately as well, my wife-to-be at the time, I'd met her when I was in Iceland. We weren't married at that time together. I'd come back to Scotland. She was still in Reykjavik. She'd moved to London to work for a company in London. So I got my degree in Scotland and I thought, you know what, I'm going to take a chance. So I moved to London and mistakenly, naively, I thought I could just go to a law firm. But no, I had to retrain again. I had to get the conversion. So I had to do a 3-year degree, law degree in 8 months, which was torture. It was something I would recommend. It was absolute torture. But I got that and naively, I thought I could just go to a law firm and say, right, you know, I'm going to be a lawyer. No, I had to train to be a lawyer, so it was 2 years of that as well. So all in all, with studying in Scotland and England and training, it took up about 8 years of my life. just retraining and going into another profession. But when I qualify, I qualified with a law firm in St Albans, just out north of London. That was about, I think it was 2009. At that point, the idea of sport and law or sports law was starting to really kick off and take shape, particularly down here in London. And I thought, oh, right, all the contacts that I'd made in football in particular, I don't need to throw them away. I can use that going forward. And London in particular at that time was a centre for sports law, as it were. So I was lucky enough, when I left my training law firm, I started with one of the big international law firms in the city in London. It was a great experience, you know, in a law firm, big hitting law firm, and dealing with sports because you were dealing with international superstars. So it just went from there, really, in a legal sense and in a job sense.
We've actually had our team of legal experts double check some questions that we're going to fire at you very quickly to ask, to make sure they're all appropriate. So who's the best opponent you've ever faced?
Best in terms of causing me problems. Every opponent I face, because of my ability or lack thereof, causes me problems. But I would probably it would be Mark Keighley. Mark Keighley.
Best teammate you've ever played with?
Probably there'd be several at Aberdeen. Alec McLeish, Jim Bett, and Hans Hulhouse. Ian Ferguson at St Mirren, Tony Fitzpatrick at St Mirren, Campbell Money at St Mirren. At Reykjavik, it would be either Good Johnson. So I couldn't pick one out of that, sorry.
Best player you ever met in a boots?
Johan Cruyff and Drew Tullett. Yeah.
Best goal scored?
I think I can safely say he's never scored that many. Best goal scored? Probably one of two. One I scored was St Mirren against Hibs at Easter Road. I played it up to Frank McAvaney lead off, and I rifled it into the net. That was a good goal. And another one when I was at Reykjavik, we played in Champions League qualifier, scored a goal against this team from Malta. I'm sure they were rubbish, but you have to beat them. I scored a goal from a corner, and it was a good header. So yeah, that was probably two of the best.
Best stadium played at?
Stadio delle Alpi. When I was at Aberdeen, we played Torino. That was something else. The old Wembley, played there for Scotland. And oddly enough, Hampden. Hampden has this is the old Hampden I'm talking about. There's nothing much to it, but when you get a full house at it, there's a kind of tribal feel about it that is hard to replicate anywhere else. But that's three of the best, I think, for me.
I remember that Torino game. Jess absolutely tore them apart in the first leg.
Yeah, I was playing a second game, you know, at Pittodrie, but we thought we had a chance, but Torino were just too good. I mean, and they got Arsenal in the quarterfinals, I think. I remember as well when I was at St Mirren, you know, that. Because when we won the cup, we qualified for the European Cup Winners' Cup. I've no spoken about that history. We got this team from Norway in the first round, Tromso. We beat them, so we put them out of the way. And we got this team in the second round from Belgium. And everybody thought, after you're beaten, you know, shooting the teams from Belgium are rubbish. And the first leg, we went over to Belgium. And we had a full team that night. And it was nothing each. But I come away from that game thinking, this team are unbelievably good. We'll do well to beat them because they were a fantastic set. You know, I think the way it turned out, they'd have the Belgian national team and they were a great team.
The Derwin Koeman as well.
Oh, yeah. Food Tom, the national keeper. Yeah. They had a few Dutch internationals, half the Belgian national. But it was at that point, they just came out of nowhere. Excellent. They're a bit like the Dundee United, I think, of Belgium, but they went around Europe battering teams. Anyway, in the second leg at St Mirren, we were expected to win. It was a full house at St Mirren, and I get injured. I wasn't playing. Ian Ferguson wasn't playing. And I think a few others weren't playing that night, and we get beat, I think, 3-1. and we got absolutely slaughtered in the press, sort of losing to Mechelen. And they went on and they battered, I think it was Dynamo, a Russian team or something, beat Atalanta and hammered Ajax in the final. And a few years later, I met our manager. I was over in New York. I don't know how the circum, but I met him. It's a guy called Ad Demos. And I'm chatting to him. And he said that we were the hardest game we played. He says, if you'd had your full team, you'd have beat us in Paisley. And I took that as a compliment. But I always remember, you know, as a team, you're not expecting it. You know, if you come up against an AC Milan or a Liverpool or whatever, you know what you're up against and you're expecting it. But this team, Mechelen, I was like, who? And we played them. And how we get nothing each in Belgium, God only knows, because we were defending for our lives. But they were a fantastic team. Brilliant, brilliant team. And, you know, time has gone on to show. I think they won the Cup Winners' Cup. And I think, did they not win the European Cup as well? Or they got to the final the following year? Because they won the Belgian League. And, you know, they were tearing up trees around Europe. And then they just, you know, had the most left and then they disappeared again. It was one of these Cinderella stories. But I always remember that with this team. They came out of nowhere and then disappeared again. You know, what a team. What a team they were.
We've already heard about your bike with Frank McAvenny, but what was the best prank you've witnessed in the game?
Best prank? Hey, I think it was probably in Iceland, actually, oddly enough. One of the boys, the goalie, he actually plays for the national team as well. The keeper, at that point, he had another job. He was a young lad. He was about 20, 21. He had another job. He was a stripper. So he'd do stripping at night, if that's the best way to describe it. He'd take his clothes off at night, but he'd be a goalkeeper during the day. Anyway, one of the other lads, just to wind him up, he was always loved his shoes. He'd fancy shoes, all of that. Anyway, long story short, one of the lads asked the groundsman for a hammer and two big nails. Because at that point, the stadium that we played at was getting redeveloped. So we were in porter cabins whilst it's been redeveloped, the changing rooms. So the floors were ruined. So one of the boys, the lad always, the stripper, the goalie, he put his shoes in certain ways. He was like anal about it. So one of the boys took the insoles out of his shoes, nailed the heel of his right through the floor and nailed his shoes to the floor and put his insoles back in. And you wouldn't think anything had happened. So he's come back in from training one day. And then he just slips into his shoes and he starts to move away. And you know that way when you go like that, you move. But it's like, you couldn't move his feet, but he's standing almost like 45 degrees. And everybody in the dressing room were peeing themselves laughing. So that prank, I think not so much as a prank, but in hindsight, laughing at it. It was that one in Singapore, you know, with the two, Abba and the other lad. Coming back for 3 days out in the jungle, as it were, you know, with Singapore, what it's like, as if nothing had happened. And they've got black eyes and, you know, they look as definitely worse for wear, as I say, something at a tenko. And just out of a pure kind of, what the hell? It's one of those moments. And again, looking back at it, you can laugh at it, but it was something that could have gone basically wrong and it would have been a major, major incident. Because the Abba and the other lad told us, the team, what they've got up to afterwards, which I'm not going to reveal. They're lucky they're here, put it this way. They're lucky they're here.
Really, what's the best nickname you've ever heard for a team?
We had a few of them at St Mirren, made a few. Paul Lambert, we used to call him Vince. Remember there was a show in the 80s, Vince Prince? There was a lad, and Paul used to have his hair like, he used to gel it back. And it was like a 60s type thing. And we used to call him Vince. And there was another guy, Brian Hamilton, we used to call him Max. And because remember there was another show again around the 80s, Max Headroom.
Yeah.
He had a big kind of square head and a haircut. Brian had a haircut like that at the time. Max Headroom, but just to shorten it, we called him Max. So that's, in terms of nicknames, that's the best one.
Well, that brings us to the end. Another episode with the revelation that former Scotland goalkeeper Campbell Money spent half time with half a pie in his head. Join us next week for another forensic journey into the annals of Scottish football. Our website is at CSI.com, where you can find all our socials. My thanks to David Winnie for being an absolutely fantastic guest. Thank you, David.
No problem at all. No problem at all.
Until next week. Cheers, bye.